are departing for Doha for an extraordinary summit where leaders of Islamic countries are planned to discuss Israeli strikes on a meeting of Hamas leaders in Qatar. The president said, with unity, Israel will not dare attack Islamic countries in violation of all international frameworks and regulations. Leaders of nearly 50 Islamic countries will participate in the Doha summit. A draft statement will reportedly condemn Israel's, quote, hostile acts. The document specifically refers to genocide, ethnic cleansing, and colonizing activities in the Palestinian territories. Well, now we are joined by Mr. Masoud Shajareh, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission there in London. As always, I'd like to thank you very much, Mr. Shajareh. Let's go straight into it. So Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian did call for unity just right before departing for Doha. And per your title, of course, how important is unity, specifically among Islamic countries and nations? As we know, during this meeting in Doha, there will be at least or nearly 50 Islamic countries attending it?
Well, extremely important. I mean, the reality is that international community as a whole, and in specifically the Islamic sort of world, has got a responsibility to rise up against the genocide, against the aggression, Israeli aggression in the whole region, what is being unleashed against Gaza, and indeed attacks on seven other countries in the region. And beyond that, I mean, we know the intention of this Zionist state is not just to commit genocide, but occupy far beyond what he's occupying right now in the name of greater Israel. And so indeed, the international community need to rise up to that challenge. They have failed so, but I think the responsibility now falls on the Muslim world with their commitment under Islamic and international sort of principles to rise up and to address this immediately with the urgency, because the international community have failed and the responsibility now lies on the Islamic world to unite and deal with this cancerous sort of regime.
Yes, and Mr. Shajareh, very briefly, if you please, in around 30 seconds, do you believe we will be seeing from Doha any type of real action carried out against the Zionist entity or condemnation as always?
Well, I hope so. I mean, this is the 11th hour. This is the time that you either do stand up or face the consequences of it. And I think if they fail so, it will be catastrophe, not just for the region, but the whole world. And I think they need to stand up to their both international and indeed Islamic responsibility.
Yes, well, Mr. Masoud Shajareh, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission there from London, thank you very much for joining us during this hour's top headlines. Mahdiyeh Isfandiari, an Iranian academic, has now been detained in France for 200 days amid growing calls for her release. As diplomatic efforts continue for her release, activists and Isfandiari's family highlight the broader issues of free speech and political motivations behind her continued imprisonment.
Today marks the 200th day since the illegal detention of Iranian academic Mahdiyeh Isfandiari in France. Isfandiari, who is 39 years old, has been detained since February 28. According to Isfandiari's friends and family, her house was thoroughly searched by security personnel, turning the incident into something eerily resembling a kidnapping. For 2 days following her arrest, no information about her whereabouts was disclosed. Furthermore, French authorities refused for an entire month to provide detailed information to the Iranian Foreign Ministry, which intervened at the family's request. The young woman is accused of, quote, advocating terrorism for having participated in a Telegram channel denouncing the ongoing genocide in Gaza. To justify her continued detention, some investigators claimed that she was acting, quote, under Iran's influence, and that this was a case of interference. accusations her lawyer, Maître Nabil Boudi, denounces as unfounded and purely political. Iranian authorities have repeatedly called for her release, describing her detention as unjust and politically motivated. Earlier this week, Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi said Tehran is close to reaching a deal with Paris that will release the Iranian female academic. He said a lot of activities have been done in this regard, adding that Esfandiari's release in exchange for French prisoners in Iran is now approaching its final stages. The top Iranian diplomat didn't give a time frame for the exchange, saying Iran's judiciary and security institutions are also involved in the process. Since her imprisonment, two requests for conditional release have been rejected, first by the Paris court in June, then by the Court of Appeal in July. Esfandiari is now in Fresnes prison, located 470 kilometers away near the capital, Paris. This considerable distance has made it extremely difficult for her family and friends to pursue her case or provide her with any form of support. She happens to be a linguist with a degree in French language from Lumiere University and has lived in the French city of Lyon for the past 8 years. She works as a professor, translator, and interpreter at Lumiere University. Activists, neighbors, and supporters of Esfandiari are denouncing what they see as a serious violation of freedom of speech. Her case is gaining increased attention as calls grow for her immediate release.
Well, Israel has intensified its genocidal campaign in Gaza, as Gaza City remains the focal point of the regime's deadly strikes. 7 people, including 3 children, were killed when an Israeli strike hit a tent sheltering the displaced families west of Gaza City. Separately, at least 10 people were killed in Israeli airstrikes targeting 2 homes on Al-Jala Street, also in Gaza City. Meanwhile, Israeli forces detonated 6 bomb-laden robots to demolish more buildings in the city. According to Gaza officials, since August 11th, more than 1,600 residential structures have been destroyed in the city alone. This as humanitarian crisis is worsening across the Israeli blockaded territory, with rising deaths from malnutrition and aid seekers being increasingly targeted by the regime forces. The death toll from the Israeli genocide since October 2023 has surpassed 64,870, with over 164,600 others injured. Well, as part of an international convoy to break the Israeli blockade on Gaza, 2 Greek aid ships and a British-flagged boat set sail for the occupied Palestinian territories.
So our aim is to, as a big fleet, manage to break the siege that's imposed by Israel and to open a humanitarian corridor for humanitarian aid into Gaza. We want to put pressure on our own governments to also stop collaborating with Israel and stop being a part of this genocide.
The Greek ships left the island of Syros and the British-flagged vessel left Tunisia. Across the expanse of the Mediterranean, the global Sumud flotilla presses on with its determined mission to break the Israeli siege on Gaza. Hundreds of activists from 44 countries are part of this international solidarity movement. The flotilla's departure was critically delayed this week following targeted attacks on its vessels. The first attack came on Monday when the flotilla's main ship, the Family, was struck and damaged by an Israeli drone attack in the Tunisian port of Sidi Bou Said. A second boat, the Alma, was attacked on Tuesday night.
More action of the Dutch government to boycott, to put sanction on Israel, because if not, this genocide will not stop against the Palestinians. And in the West Bank, they are building more and more settlements, so the two-state solution is further and further away. And they commit murders on journalists also.
We are here today to draw a red line against the genocidal violence that Israel has put on Gaza and the Palestinian people in general, and how our Dutch government is complicit in the genocide that is unfolding right now in Gaza. We are here because we think it's time to take action, and that the government is being too lazy to actually do anything to stop this genocide and the starvation of the Palestinian people in Gaza right now.
I'm here with the Dutch people to support my country and to stop the aggression, the mass extermination, and the genocide that is taking place in Gaza in a way that goes beyond all statements and beyond all events, wars, and everything that has happened to us throughout history. There is no more Gaza, unfortunately. Gaza is undergoing genocide. There is no red light for Israel to stop, neither from America or anyone else. Where is humanity? Where are the countries that can make a decision to stop what is happening?
Well, in the UK city of Birmingham, campaigners, politicians, and members of the public have gathered to tackle the Palestinian issue and Israel's occupation of Palestine. Saeed Purezah reports.
For decades, the so-called two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine question has dominated Western diplomacy, enshrined in the controversial Oslo Accords of the early 1990s. 30 years on, many here say that solution was dead on arrival.
It's impossible now, in any event, even if it was desirable, which I don't think it ever was, to actually create a two-state proposition, because the West Bank, for example, has been completely atomized by the Zionist entity. So I think we need to rip that idea up and to start again, and what we're campaigning for is a one-state solution.
Critics of the two-state solution, now pushed for by Saudi Arabia and France at the United Nations, also pointed to Israel's ongoing genocidal assault on Gaza.
What they are actually doing is consolidating the gains made by the Zionist entity, which includes the absolute annihilation of Gaza, the continued terrorism that is being taken place by Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And what they actually want to do is consolidate the 80-odd years of Zionist settler colonialism.
The debate organized by activist independent movement grew heated, with some arguing for a state, including all Palestinians and those who live in what's now called Israel, if they wish to stay.
Every Palestinian should have the right to return. And Israelis who decide they want to stay will have obligation to assist the Palestinian to settle back to their home, and that means everywhere.
Opponents of that view argue it resembles South Africa after the end of apartheid, when many of the immigrant white population got to stay.
The concept of, you know, what is mine and what is yours is so simple, and actually people are trying to pretend there's shades of grey. No, actually it's very black and white. There's Palestine, and there's a fake terrorist construct called Israel that needs to be dismantled.
Dr. Ali also suggests that armed struggle by Palestinians is the only pathway to one state being materialized.
Armed struggle is legal under international law. And rather than, you know, and what we should be doing is arguing for deprescription of perfectly legitimate legal organizations under international law, we should be never condemning resistance.
At the end of the debate, it was obvious which motion received more support. With the Israeli regime openly rejecting Palestinian statehood as it commits genocide in Gaza, the debate here mirrors a wider global reckoning. The two-state solution has repeatedly failed. The consensus here, a one-state solution with equal rights for all the indigenous inhabitants of historical Palestine. Saeed Purezah from Birmingham, United Kingdom.
The Yemeni army has launched another anti-Israel operation in support of the Palestinian people, striking the regime's targets in the occupied territories with drones.
The UAV force of the Yemeni armed forces conducted a qualitative military operation involving four drones. Three drones targeted Ramon Airport in the Ar-Rashrash area, while the fourth hit a military site in the Negev region of the occupied Palestine. The operation successfully met its intended objectives.
Sadia said the strikes were carried out in response to the crimes of genocide and starvation committed by Israel against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. He added that the operation also came into retaliation for the Israeli aggression against Yemen. Sadia affirmed that Yemen will continue to uphold its religious, moral, and humanitarian responsibilities towards its brothers in Gaza until Israel's aggression against its territory ends and its siege is lifted. Thank you very much. That's all we have for you this hour. Goodbye for now.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. Yesterday we discussed that one of the great challenges that our Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his family, faced came from the hands of the hypocrites, from the munafiqun. It is these hypocrites who lived amongst the Muslims. They claimed to be Muslim. They fulfilled many of the responsibilities of Muslims. And yet, even though they did all of these external things, Iman never entered their hearts. And because they never really accepted Islam, but they did these things just to be part of the wider Muslim Ummah and get the benefits from that, as we talked about, they constantly spread corruption within the land. They constantly spread fitna within the land, discord within the people, and chaos. And this is why we quoted this hadith that's reported of the Prophet yesterday, where we said, where the Prophet is reported to have said that inni akhafu alaykum kulla munafiq, that I fear for you the hypocrites within the community. Why? Because they are alim al-lisan, yaquluna ma ta'rifun. They are pleasant to hear. They are eloquent in speech. They say what you like to hear. Wa yaf'aluna ma tunkirun. But they act in a manner that upsets you. You know, the existence of hypocrisy, as we talked about, did not begin with risala, nor did it end with the risala, with the end of the risala. But all the imams face some form of hypocrisy from the society and from the leaders. And you find that our eighth imam, alayhi salam's period in particular, the hypocrisy from the leadership and the caliph of that time was in a very profound state, in a very heightened state. You know, you look at the history of the caliphs that came, especially after Karbala, majority of them did not hide their animosity for the Ahlul Bayt. They tolerated them, yeah, they kept them close to them, but at the same time, they did not hide the fact that they had bughd and rancor in their hearts for the family of the Prophet. But Ma'mun took a different approach. Yeah, Ma'mun was one of the few caliphs who actually changed his tone and presented himself as a lover of the Ahlul Bayt, right? He presented himself as one who cared about the Prophet's family. And this is why he offered his throne, he offered his leadership, whatever he had to the Imam alayhi salam. But the subtext was understood as well, that he was doing these things to carry favor with the people. He wanted the people who were upset at his father killing Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam to not turn against him. And so he presented this external demeanor of faith, external demeanor of love for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, so that he could keep the Imam under tax. And this is the definition of hypocrisy, right? Where one externally presents themselves in a manner that is internally not how they actually are. And of course, our eighth Imam alayhi salam knew this. It wasn't that it was hidden from the eighth Imam, but part of the responsibility of the A'imma alayhim salam was to deal with the nifaq of the munafiqun, right? Of the hypocrisy of the hypocrites. Let's find this very beautiful hadith in the book Uyun Akhbar al-Ridha, where our eighth Imam al-Ridha alayhi afdalu salatu wassalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, he describes the role of an imam. And this is, in a way, it's nice to hear what he describes the imams with, but then there's a part that we have to pay attention to. He says, Al-imamu, or he's reported to have said, Al-imamu aminullah fi ardi, that imams are the trustees of Allah upon this earth. Wa hujjatahu ala ibadi, and his proof upon the servants of Allah. Wa khalifatahu fi biladi, and he is the representative of the vicegerent in his cities. Adda'i ilallah wa dha'abu an huramillah, that they are the callers to Allah and the defenders of the sanctity of Allah. These are the positions or the role that an imam carries. Al-imamu al-mutahhiru min al-dhunub, he is pure from any type of sins. Al-mubarra'u min al-uyub, and he is free from any type of deficiencies. Al-makhsusu bil-ilm mawsumun bil-hilm, and that they are filled with knowledge and they are overflowing with forbearance. Nidhamuddin wa izzul muslimin, and they are the ones who bring order to religion and the stronghold of believers. But then he says something really beautiful, and they are ghaydhul munafiqeen, they are the ones who are the cause of a hatred in the hypocrites. This is the role of the imams, you know. You know, hypocrites need someone to hate. Yeah, because if there was no one to have their animosity towards, there would be no hypocrisy. And here we find that the imams were that fuel for the hypocrites. Yeah, that they were the ones who brought that extra flame or that extra fire into the hearts of hypocrites. And this is something that hypocrisy is never empty of, this dislike for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, this dislike for the family of the Prophet. There's this really beautiful hadith where our first Imam Ali alayhi afdalu salatu wassalam, Amma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, where he's reported to have said that if I were to strike a believer on the nose for that believer to hate me, that believer would never hate me. Yeah? But if I were to give everything in this world to a munafiq for them to love me, that munafiq would never love me. Yeah? Why? Because he said, I heard the Prophet say, Ya Ali, la yuhibbuka illa mu'min, wa la yubghiduka illa munafiq. Yeah? That Ya Ali, that only a believer will love you, and only a hypocrite will dislike you. So it's this concept of hypocrisy that we began yesterday, and that I want to take going forward, inshallah. As we said, this will be a series that will last maybe 6 or 7 lectures, still working on it. But we're going to try to cover the following things in the series to give us a robust understanding. Inshallah, in the next coming lectures, we're going to look at the definition of hypocrisy from a linguistic and a religious context. And we will also look at God's warnings of hypocrisy. Like, what does Allah Azza wa Jal say, and how does He describe the munafiqun? Then we will also look at the different forms of hypocrisy. There are 3 types, or 2 main types of hypocrisy. The second has 2 branches, but we will look at each one in detail. And in particular, not only are we going to look at it from the Quranic and the Hadith literature, but we're going to try to see how that applies to us in our world today. That do we see these forms of hypocrisy in our world, or do we not? Or is this something that we just have to be cautious about? We will try to understand that. Then we will also look at the signs and the attributes of those who are considered hypocrites in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then how to cure hypocrisy in case we find that when I look at my heart, I have some traces of hypocrisy. How do I cure that? And then some other signs or other quote-unquote suggestions that we find in our literature of how to safeguard ourselves when we are around people who are hypocrites. So you can tell the discussion is quite extensive on this subject, and we're trying to make sure that we don't leave any holes in it so that we have more questions later. And so we'll try to make something robust out of it.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
could believe fish falling from the sky, or frogs for that matter. These events sound more like scenes from a science fiction movie than actual news. Even if we weren't living in an age of fake news, accepting such stories would still be difficult. Yet, some seemingly impossible phenomena are real. Rainfalls of fish and frogs do occasionally occur in certain parts of the world. The cause of this strange phenomenon is rare storms. Storms powerful enough to lift aquatic creatures from the sea into the sky and drop them back down over land. In 2018, the company Cambridge Analytica found itself at the center of a major scandal. The controversy dated back 2 years before the election, to a time when Facebook had managed to collect data from thousands of users. These data sets were part of users' private information, yet they were secretly handed over to Cambridge Analytica. The data even included details about users' friends, and the company ultimately gained access to information from over 50 million individuals.
We think that the only personal information they have about us is what we've given them. And we think we can exert some control over what we give them. And therefore, we think that our calculation, our trade-off here, is something that is somehow under our control, that we understand.
Behavioral economics was an approach that extended its influence into other domains. If it could be used to change a president, then other tasks, like marketing and selling a product, were also possible. Marketers showed interest in this approach. They monitored people's behavior, analyzed it, and based on the results, took action to, for example, increase the sales of a product. This approach was a form of surveillance-based market, which transformed the way products were sold.
I can see how people with these characteristics typically behave over time, and that allows me to fit your data right into that arc and to predict what you're likely to do, not only now, but soon and later. This is what I call behavioral surplus. These data streams filled with these rich predictive data. Why surplus? Because right from the start, these were more data than was required to improve products and services.
Pepsi's Number Fever campaign in the Philippines has probably gone down in history as one of the biggest marketing disasters in history, mainly because of a human error that led Pepsi to print more winning caps than they planned. The resulting chaos caused riots, civil unrest, and even deaths.
The late years of the 20th century marked the era of monopolies, a time of ruthless competition among corporate giants to dominate consumer markets. These companies used every tactic imaginable to defeat their rivals. Marketing had turned into a battlefield, one that spanned the entire globe, from Latin America to Africa, and from there to East Asia, including the Philippines. The Philippines had been a colony of the United States for years, and even after gaining independence, little changed. Repeated interference in the country's politics and culture amounted to indirect colonialism, a solution that suited Western corporations well. Major companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi saw opportunity. In the early 1990s, these two rivals turned the Philippines into a battleground. They did everything they could to bring each other down, although Coca-Cola was usually more successful. In 1992, Pepsi's marketers fired their last shot to defeat their competitor. They launched a promotional contest. Each bottle of Pepsi contained a number, and if someone found the winning number, they'd receive a cash prize. The campaign captured the attention of millions of poor Filipinos.
I won!
Look for the winning number in Farisari stores every day, off on TV, radio, newspapers. You could be a millionaire.
Pepsi sales skyrocketed, Coca-Cola stumbled, and the fever of the contest swept across the country. Pepsi became scarce. Some people bought dozens of bottles, not for daily consumption, but in hopes of winning. This continued until the moment of the draw, a tense moment that ended with the announcement of number 349. Everyone wanted to know who the winner was. Within minutes, it was revealed that a housewife had the winning number, but a strange problem arose. A bus driver also claimed to have the same number. Hours later, a tailor said he had it too. And it didn't stop there. The next day, thousands of people across the Philippines claimed they had number 349.
People were dancing in the streets, celebrating. They thought their problems were over. They were millionaires. It's still not certain exactly how many winners there were of lucky 349 bottle caps, but we know that Pepsi printed over 600,000 of them.
Pepsi quickly issued a statement. Company executives announced that the winning number had been printed not once, but thousands of times, meaning there would be no winner in the contest. People were furious. They had spent months investing time and money, and now with a single statement, everything had been swept away. Those holding the winning number saw Pepsi's response as a major insult, one that demanded protest. What followed over the next few months resembled a crime drama. Protests outside Pepsi factories, clashes, political turmoil, official statements, and ultimately the decision by demonstrators to file lawsuit. The protesters accused Pepsi of colonial behavior, while Pepsi labeled them as agitators. Rumors spread that Pepsi executives had paid criminal groups to incite violence under the guise of protest. Several bombings, fatalities, and hundreds of arrests followed, all seemingly aimed at discrediting the protesters in the public eye. No one could believe that the security of an entire country and the lives of millions had been disrupted over a single mistaken number. Everyone knew Pepsi would never be held accountable for its actions. This was the nature of marketing campaigns: profit-driven, exploitative, and ultimately dismissive of reality. A century had passed since the invention of this profession, a profession that had infected the entire world with consumerism. The Pepsi incident was only the beginning.
So, it's the middle of the night, we're in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and look what we've got. See all this stuff? Look. Look. Hats, t-shirts, badges, posters, stickers, CD, torch. Now all this stuff is clearly the promotional material for some multi-million dollar movie like Armageddon or Godzilla. Except, of course, it isn't. Because unlikely as it sounds, all this is actually the byproduct of a film that cost around $35,000 to make, that was shot by two Florida film school graduates who'd never made a feature before and didn't even expect this one to get released.
Marketing was no longer just a profession. It had become like a contagious disease, like a virus, widespread and deadly. This disease was infiltrating country after country, and now it was becoming more terrifying than ever. Even more frightening than the Blair Witch Project, a famous film from those years that was rumored to contain real footage discovered by the police. The footage told the chilling story of three documentary filmmakers. These three young people set out to make a documentary about a murderous witch, but strange things began to happen to them. The footage showed that they had disappeared in the Black Hills forest. Viewers were left wondering, what happened to these three? The film was released just as the internet was becoming widespread. Websites constantly wrote about it, about the legend of the witch and the fate of the filmmakers.
The filmmakers also used the internet to draw the audience into their nightmare, publicizing the movie with a Blair Witch website, which treated the events depicted as real. They fortuitously sparked off a network of mirror sites, all of which got the world believing in the mythology of the Blair Witch. I mean, why bother with huge advertising budgets when word of mouth, as it's now referred to, can put you in touch with armies of fans convinced that the truth is out there?
Audiences would send this content to each other via email, and this very act led more people to go to the cinema.
BlairWitch.com.
Really, the website was kind of like a medium for the mythology, so we all created the mythology and threw it up there as kind of for people to find out about. Ed formatted the site in such a way to where it was a kind of interactive experience.
The film quickly grossed $250 million. Even though its budget was reportedly only $200,000, it was a major victory for Artisan Entertainment, though it seemed a bit strange. But the big question was the story real? Websites claimed yes, it was completely real, but gradually it became clear that both the film and its marketing were a massive lie, a lie worth $250 million.
I just wanted the website to just kind of be this investigative website that basically treated this case as if it were real. And I think that's what people dug it. And so, you know, it just became kind of a playground, really, for a lot of people that were interested in the movie. And it generated an incredible fan base.
Of course, Artisan had deliberately orchestrated this lie. A lie that today is known as viral marketing. It's a form of advertising that was invented in that very decade, operating much like the spread of a virus. All it took was the creation of compelling content. The rest was handled by the digital world and its users. People thought they were sharing entertaining texts or images with their friends, but in reality, they were spreading a marketing campaign. That content quickly infected the minds of millions. There was no direct advertising. It was only about cleverly crafted, seductive side stories.
So this is where the trail of the Blair Witch has led us so far. Where do we go from here? I have no idea, because I'm completely lost in the dark. The only advice I'd give you is believe nothing you hear or read. Because in the end, the Blair Witch Project is everything you'd hope for and nothing you'd expect. And that really is scary.
Once again, marketing had used a clever trick to pocket people's money. A trick made possible by the internet. For marketers, the internet was like the town square of the Middle Ages, a place to stir up commotion, a space that, in the modern era, was destined to become the central hub of marketing. The internet and smartphones transformed the path of advertising. These technologies were useful, but marketers preferred their darker side. To them, the internet cable was like a rope that bound the entire planet, creating something akin to a prison. A place where its inhabitants could be monitored and monetized. Critics called this phenomenon surveillance marketing.
And the question is, how can your brain be hacked? And the answer is, well, it doesn't get hacked with computer code, but it gets hacked with false information. And in fact, we've had false information since the time of the Romans. It's called propaganda. So what's the difference between marketing, which is what companies say they do, and propaganda? And the answer is the truth. That's the difference. When companies express a point of view that furthers their goals, then that point of view references true facts. That's called marketing. When a company expresses a point of view and tries to advance its goals based on misinformation, that's called propaganda. So the difference between marketing and propaganda is the truth. The corporations of America today have engaged in a very specific attempt to market their propaganda in order to get us to do different things than we might otherwise have done.
In this type of marketing, every behavior is a data point. Writing or searching for any word becomes content for analysis. Marketers, like prison guards, monitor every single action. They have a century of experience behind them and an ocean of information ahead. Our data is recorded and handed over to artificial intelligence. AI takes all the data and turns it into analysis, precise interpretations of our rational and irrational behaviors. Of course, irrational behaviors are a better raw material for marketers. The stranger our behavior online, the more diverse the data becomes. Diverse data leads to richer analyses, and these analyses form the foundation of prediction, predicting our needs, reactions, and thoughts. This information is highly valuable. The internet and surveillance marketing complement each other. It's a combination that creates the perfect opportunity for charlatans and the ideal space for selling products. Sometimes the product is an object. Sometimes it's an idea. Trump's election and that company's scandal were products of this era, an era of marketing abuse and exploitation of the human mind. Watching him raised another question. What will humanity's future look like under surveillance marketing? A future in which humans are the prey and marketers the hunters.
Thank you. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history, 2016. Imam Khamenei. After the passage of 3 years or more in the first phase of Bi'tha, the Holy Prophet ﷺ had managed to convert 30 or 40 people to Islam through his covert call to Islam. Then a divine order was issued, therefore declare openly that thou art commanded, and turn away from the polytheists. The Holy Quran, chapter 15, verse 94. Requiring the Holy Prophet ﷺ to raise flag of Islam and to openly call people to Islam. The Holy Prophet ﷺ did so, being concerned about the safety of the Holy Prophet and his enemy's plots, Abi Talib went to him and told him the message of the chiefs of Mecca. Dear uncle, even if they place the sun in my right hand and the moon in my left hand to prevent me from achieving this goal, I swear by Allah that I will not do as they say. The Holy Prophet replied. Then the Prophet's eyes were filled with tears and he got up to leave. Having observed this faith and steadfastness, Abi Talib was impressed and said, Dear nephew, go and say whatever you like. He told him to pursue his goal. I swear by God that I will not give you away, no matter what I receive in return. This steadfastness bred more steadfastness. This steadfastness on the part of the Holy Prophet ﷺ strengthened the roots of steadfastness in the heart of Abi Talib. Pursuing the goals, not fearing the enemy, not being tempted by what the enemy has to offer, and not being dependent on the privileges that the enemy offers to prevent one from treading the path one believes in, give rise to resistance, peace, trust in the path, the goal, and God who this goal belongs to. There were not more than 30 or 40 of them. These 30 or 40 people tolerated all those hardships and increased in number on a daily basis. Each day, they were witness to what they did to Ammar and Bilal. They were witness to the torturing and martyrdom of Sumayyah and Yasir. They were witness to these things, but they still converted to Islam. That is the way righteousness is promoted. The mere rising of the flag in peace and security will not help promote righteousness. Righteousness will be promoted only when there is steadfastness and perseverance on the part of righteous people who believe in righteousness.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to all our listeners from around the world. I'm Asma here in Tehran announcing our program schedule for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We start tonight's lineup with today's special daily mix format program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. That will be followed by Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. Then we have our radio productions feature. And to round up this hour's programs, we have Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today.